actually, this is Andrea Liu's talk. And I'm going to make some remarks about the jamming transition, blast transitions, and something to do with K-chord. But first, I want to make a few informal remarks. Oh, let me say that, well, Andrea is not here. This is something that I'm very sorry about. She would want me to have the names of all of her collaborators. You don't need to look at this one, because that's already on the TV set. But these people have made some important contributions, especially Leo Seller and Jen Schwartz. But as sorry as I am that Andrea isn't here, because she's a dear friend of mine, probably by the end of this talk, you're going to be even more sorry. So what I'm going to talk about is, well, joint work with Andrea Liu and Jen Schwartz. That's a picture of her. It doesn't actually look anything like her, as Alan will testify to. They used to be in the chemistry department, but now they've gone to different places. She's at UPenn Physics, and Jen is at Syracuse. This also represents a lot of thoughts that I've had with Merrick Biskup and Alan Smith. And, well, look, he's thinking very hard. And then also I want to talk about maybe some old work with John Macta and Carol Stengel, who was my graduate student, and Anthony Canelio. But let's leave these people on the board, and let me make a few informal remarks. I mean, somehow, at least from the perspective of somebody who's interested in statistical mechanics, this conference is all about phase transitions. So I draw a typical phase diagram. This is temperature. This is not necessarily zero temperature, pressure. And I'm interested in liquid vapor. So I have some curve like this. And if you go into this phase diagram, cross this line, you go from a vapor to a liquid. One important thing is that it's easy to identify in these circumstances what is the condensate. I mean, you don't see any liquid, and then when you get to this point, you see some liquid in the system, and you go, aha, that is what's condensing. If you do this generically, the transition will be first order. You will have a condensate fraction versus, this is the inverse temperature, so going this way means going that way, and you sort of basically have nothing. And then you have something that looks like that. If you're clever enough to go through the critical point, the condensate makes it's not really there, but it makes its presence felt. It makes its presence felt on all length scales. And you can see this in a phenomenon called critical opalescence, because the scales of clusters become comparable to that of visible light. Now, we never study systems like this. We usually study systems like this. And this has a phase transition. I have something called the magnetization. Here again, beta represents the inverse of the temperature. And I look at the magnetization as a function of beta. There's a beta C. Below this critical temperature, the magnetization is zero, and then it rises. And what is the magnetization? Well, I can write down a formula for the magnetization. I'll politely not write down a thermodynamic formula, but a statistical mechanics formula. I look at the sum of the spins inside the box, divided by the volume of the box, and this goes to m of beta under the right circumstances. And that begs the question, well, what is the condensate in this system? What is the condensate? There's another type of model we look at, percolation. I won't even bother to define it. It's not that important. You look at bonds, which are distributed independently, and you ask what fraction of the sites belongs to the infinite cluster. So, the infinity, the parameter for occupation is P. And pretty much the same. Of course, the details of how this goes to zero are different. That's important. But in percolation, there's no doubt in anyone's mind what the condensate is. It is the infinite cluster itself. The condensate appears in these models as a hidden variable, very, very mysterious, and sometimes, most often, very difficult to identify. You can make a graphical representation. I'll have a little more to say about this later. And the graphical representation makes this system look very much like this system. And then you can talk about the infinite cluster in the context of the graphical representation. And in a very serious way, that represents the condensate. And this is a phenomenon I want to illustrate. What do we do here? We look at some sample. Typical thing for percolation, everyone seems to be in love with the hexagonal tiling problem, but percolation is often looked at as a bond problem. And you would look at the measure at PC, conditioned on the fact that there's a connection across the sample. At P equals PC, there is no condensate, but you're forcing a long cluster into the system. And this is somehow interesting. You can always do this. You can do this for P less than PC. But what's important about the situation at PC is that although the probability of actually observing this all by itself goes to zero, it only does so slowly. So in some sense, you're not drastically altering the system, and you're bringing out the condensate. Now, from the perspective of the dual model, this means that there is no opposing connection between the opposite phases.
What do you mean by slow?
Power law.
Of what?
Of system size.
No.
Yes?
It's not true.
This has...
It's exactly 1/2 the square.
No, particular points. Particular points.
Ah, okay.
Particular points. For easing, it looks like you have no choice but to do what everyone's been doing with black and white hexagons. You make the same system, you put in plus spins and minus spins, and try to look at the interface. But I claim, in fact, this is the same thing. In the representation where the condensate makes itself manifest, this implies, technically in the dual model, a connection between here and here, because this condition implies that there can be no connection between there and there. Now, everything that we've seen, at least in direct connection with phase transitions and statistical mechanics models, has more or less focused on paths. And presumably in these models, well, it's been proven. These paths are described by various examples of SLE kappa. And one expects that most, if not all, statistical mechanics models that you would want to think about on a, what is it, Tuesday afternoon, are described by something like this, with kappa in the range between 0 and 8. Now, every time that anyone's been bringing up SLE kappa for kappa bigger than 8, it's sort of the butt of some joke. So, one of the questions that I think might be of interest today is to begin to try to think about what situations are interesting from the perspective of SLE kappas when the kappas are big. Having said that, I will now proceed with the talk. So jamming. Jamming in physics is a new concept, more or less, that ties together a lot of unsolved problems, the classic unsolved problems in condensed matter physics, in particular the glass transition.
Can you do something like that, please?
I don't know how to do it.
All right.
Now you have to
So it's an old problem. The problem of the glass transition is an old problem. Here's a picture from Andrea's talk. You see guys 500 years ago worrying about the glass transition. But let me sort of summarize by saying that what happens in a glass transition or a glass-like transition, you have materials and they undergo something that looks like a phase transition, where they go from a liquid state to a state that is less liquid-like. For example, you see church glass and you go, that's not a liquid, but on the other hand, some of the ancient church glasses that are around, been around since those guys were in the glass transition, are thicker at the bottom than they are at the top. Because over the centuries, the glass has been flowing. So it's a question maybe of divergent time scales. There is the glass transition. There is the gel transition in foams. There is the colloidal glass transition and a number of other things, supercooled liquids, emulsions, granular material. Are these transitions thermodynamic? And the answer, by and large, is that it's not clear. And I want to say something. I can say this because Andrea isn't here. I don't think she would say it. Andrea and her collaborators have done some deep thinking about this problem. And, you know, there's advantages that the problem has been around a long time, because that means that there's a lot of work been done and a lot of data been collected. But the disadvantage of a problem being so old is that, well, they're entrenched camps. And either you're with group A, group B, group C, and anybody who's not in the union of the first four or five groups, well, it's sort of very hard to get your voice heard. And so therefore, the fact that this work that I'll be alluding to a little bit has had some impact is a remarkable feat. So these are the relevant references. Andrea is on just about all of them, along with Nagel and, well, various other collaborators. The idea is, if you look at a phase diagram, you have temperature, I think we all understand, density of stuff, and then load is somehow external stress. You find that there's sort of a surface inside of which you're in a glassy state, outside of which you have a liquid. A surface is not really a good description. It's more sort of a rough, mushy region. However, there is good evidence for one clean thermodynamic transition, regardless of what's happening here, and that's at this point, which is called point J, or the J point. Now, if you look at sort of a generic model that's supposed to describe all this physics in this extended space, what is happening at the J point is the following.
Could you say very precisely what point that is?
It's the point at which this model that I'm about to explain is relevant. So it's a zero temperature. It's a zero temperature model.
Wasn't it zero stress?
Zero stress and also zero temperature. It's on one axis. So let me describe this.
Am I going to present the evidence that you said was strong?
Evidence for what?
For thermodynamic thinking?
Yes.
Whatever.
Yes, I'm going to show you what the thermodynamic thinking is and what the results have shown. So let me describe the model. So you have particles. Particles interact repulsively. Hard spheres are not going to do. You need something soft. I don't want to go to the details because I don't think the details are so important. So particles have repulsive interaction if they overlap, and no interaction at all if they don't. And the dynamics is such that the particles move in such a way as to try to lower the energy. So what happens? Well, you know, the simulations are very difficult, so they do these multi-step algorithms, but I don't think anything like that is of any significance. If you do Monte Carlo update, the same thing would happen. So I hope you saw that. I didn't. But particles sort of tend to move away from each other. And now, what is the result of doing these simulations? Well, we need a set of axes. And on one axis is the density. So you start out with a random configuration with density rho. And on the other is after the system comes into equilibrium, after Monte Carlo doesn't want to move anything around anymore, what is the fraction of particles that end up overlap with one another? And that is the result that you get. It looks kind of like the first order transition. It does. However, the key observation is that there's an important difference. The rise from the discontinuity is not analytic. And let me show some data. I want to show that data. So, just below this critical value, no particles overlap. And above, there is a fraction that overlaps. And here are the numbers. This, you will notice, in 2D is equal to 2D, more or less. And this, in 3D, is also equal to 2D. That's more important for what maybe Andrea had to say than for what I have to say. But it is interesting and not entirely understood. If you have non-analytic behavior, you should look for critical exponents, and you get a beta value of just about a half. There's a shear modulus, something like a response function. This factor is trivial. It has only to do with the nature of the soft core repulsion. You get a gamma, and the gamma is about a half. And then there's not one, but actually two correlation length exponents, which is was more in dispute a few years ago than it is now. But at any rate, there are values of about a quarter and a half. Now, I'm not going to study this model, I'm going to study the different
model. So let me repeat my question. Mm-hmm. Are you going to present the evidence?
Sure.
Wait.
Right after the talk.
I don't want to talk about that model, I want to talk about a different model. A model that you really understand. So here's the problem that we want to study, and it's called K-core percolation. Now, the study of K-core percolation is not entirely new. It goes back to the 70s. And in fact, there's been a difficult, exhaustive study on the complete graph version of the model by Patel, Spencer, Walmart. Let me first define the model. Sort of generically, K is an integer. We'll take K has to be bigger than 3. So you take a lattice, there's a lattice, and you do ordinary percolation. So some bonds fill up, okay? Now the idea is that you're gonna kill everything that isn't triply connected. So to start, let's clear off all the edges and things which aren't being used. Fun begins after you occupy the lattice. Why these things are flashing, I do not know. There's a lot about this. Anyway, the edges are gone. This guy's isolated. He's not connected to anybody. So we get rid of that. And get rid of everybody who's known not to be connected to three neighbors. So people, they die off very quickly. Slash again. Right? Almost there. Looks like there's going to be nothing left. He's gone. See, the point is, it iterates. Once you get rid of some people, then other people who used to have three neighbors, because of the people that are now eliminated, no longer have three neighbors. But if you don't end up with nothing, then what you have is called the K-core, the three corners. So, two questions. First, why is jamming anything like K-core? And second, why a problem like that, which is after all just another percolation problem, might be of interest to talk about? Well, we'll get to that a little later. I want to do first a quick mean field analysis of the K-core problem. And so By mean field, I mean a complete graph problem. So you have the model is exactly the following. You have n vertices, and you have bonds with probability alpha over n, and n is your parameter, alpha is your parameter, and you try to take n to infinity and see which is the star. Now, I will do a sort of informal, a cavity calculation. We never made any of this. How did we get it all? Push this? So, in order to understand how this system works, you actually have to think a little bit about what the relevant variable is that you might want to talk about. Again, sort of the idea of what is the condensate? And it's not exactly the K core. It starts with the core itself. So let's pretend all these are somehow triply connected. Then there's something that's called fluff, we call fluff. And fluff, well, the best way to define it is inductively. So here's the K core. And then you ask, are these two members, are these two sites in the fluff? Well, they are if they have two connections to the K core. And let's call that the first generation fluff. And then the second generation fluff is defined by those people who have at least two connections to the first generation union the core. That's the second generation. And so on. You then look at the union of all these sites, and that's the fluff. Now, from this you can derive sort of mean field recursion relations, and that, these are available in the large work on this model. So, as I mentioned before, you have n sites, and all bonds are occupied with probability alpha over n. And let's let Tn denote the total amount of core and fluff after, if you just have n sites. All right. Now, there it is. Well, all this is the fluff and core, and then these guys were left out. Let's bring in a new site and ask, are you in the fluff or the core? And in order to join the total, well, you have to have at least k minus 1 connections into the total. Well, this one has two, so it turns hot pink. And now let's calculate the probability of this. We'll do explicitly k equals 3. Well, calculate what is the probability of no bonds into the total, and that's probability of a vacant bond to the Tn. Probability of exactly one bond is given by this formula. Now I'm going to sort of take n to infinity and assume that Tn looks like a constant times n, which is called phi infinity, and then all these go over into nice exponential functions. And that gives me the equation, the probability of being in the fluff and core is given by this formula. Now let's ask ourselves, could such a thing, we'll look for solutions to that equation, non-trivial solutions. Is there any non-trivial solution where this order parameter is small? And the answer is no. Because if you assume that it's small, then you can expand all these complicated functions. And if you do, you get the, I did a bad thing. You get that phi is asymptotically equal to phi squared times a constant, and no small number except zero satisfies. So either phi is zero or phi is something substantial. It cannot go to zero. That's interesting. That's an interesting phenomenon, I think. Now, the next transparency, let me not talk about this. I mean, in some sense, it is a genuine first-order transition in the sense that how you prepare the system, you can exhibit this condensate that has a fraction, or you can have something in which the condensate is absent altogether. I don't know if I want to call that phase coexistence anymore, even though that's what's on the transparency. Anyway, I don't want to talk about K for a while. So let's go back to jamming, the jamming transition. Now, the question that I raised, what does jamming have to do with K4 percolation? And in a certain sense, well, in the sense of physics, it's just about the same problem. See, if a particle has too few interactions with neighboring particles, then it's going to move out of their vicinity. And at least in the limit of a dilute system, it's out of the dynamics altogether. So if you don't have enough neighbors, you get eliminated. But then the things that you used to be coordinated with, they may not have enough neighbors, and they can get eliminated. So here's an illustration of that phenomenon. The question might be, what is too few? Well, the gospel, according to St. Shlomo, is that it's exactly 2 plus 1. That's not important, really. What's important is that there is a critical number. There's a force balance involved in this, but well, it is an important feature, but not in the broad picture that I want to discuss about. So, for all intents and purposes, you eliminate particles that aren't well enough coordinated, and you see what's left. Now, I want you to recall something. That's the behavior of this system. Question. Does this happen with K-core? And the answer is yes. This actually was well known. Beta lattice solution. We had the exact formula for that. Notice the non-analytic rise. So if I were to assign some kind of critical exponent to that, it would be a half. And that's peculiar. It's peculiar to have a non-analyticity rising out on top of a first-order transition. Now, anything else? Well, you recall that for the J point, there were other critical indices, correlation length indices, response function indices. Two divergent correlation length exponents, nu sharp and nu star, and two divergent response functions, actually, although I only mentioned one. And the next question you want to ask, having noted that is also peculiar. Two phase transitions happening on top of one another. Does that happen with K-core percolation? And this is, this is the study that we did, Jen Schwartz and myself and Andrea. We did sort of a detailed beta lattice calculation, so all you can do at this point. You can consider the two-point correlation function. So A is a site, and IA is the indicator of the event that the site A belongs to the K-core. So this would be some sort of truncated correlation function, average of that. And you can fix A and sum over all B, and let's call that chi-sharp. Now, this is divergent at the transition P, and it diverges like 1 over P minus PT, typical mean field behavior. So let's write down that gamma sharp is 1. But there's something else you can do. You can add an external field. I'm not going to describe it. Sort of allow, in a very dilute sense, some particles to get stabilized by connection to infinity. And if you do that, you get a susceptibility type response with a different exponent, a half, 1. And there's a correlation length associated with this particular response function, and it has an exponent of 1/4. So that gives nu sharp equals 1/4, and actually, I would much rather that it was nu star equals 1/4, so I'm just going to change it, even though I have no reason to justify that. I'm a little confused about that. There's a lot of things in this that are very peculiar, and I think definitely merit further study. So there's apparently continuous transition sitting on top of a first order transition. And there's two sets of exponents associated with the continuous transition. Here's one of them. I know that some of these actually belong on the other list, but I'm putting them over here. And there's even a delta exponent, but I won't discuss anything about that. These are the typical mean field exponents, and these are not. So the first thing you can say, okay, well, I know about other mean field theories. There's the tricritical mean field theory. But those are the tricritical mean field exponents, and this list is not the same as that. In particular, that has nu equals a half. In fact, there's a more than a theorem, an axiom. I raise the ghost of Landau, who says, the index nu has the value of a half in any transition point of the second term. After a while, that was modified to the sentence in Landau theory, but at the time that it was said, all critical indices. So you have a set of mean field exponents that hasn't been seen before much. So that takes me to another chapter in the story. This happened a long time ago. You look at percolation. You can describe the model by saying I have a parameter so that the probability of looking at a bond configuration is given by the Bernoulli probability. Add another parameter to that, and you get something called the random cluster model. You simply weight that formula with Q, the number of connected components. Now, this is the hidden graphical representation that I was talking about earlier. So in particular, the integer values of Q correspond to graphical representations of the various Q-state POTS model, and as just about everybody knows, easing magnet corresponds to Q equals 2. So this is nothing new, but if you're, it has a critical P. And if you're beyond the critical P, you can look at fluctuations of the constant. So P infinity X is the event that the cited X is in the condensate. And I can look at the fluctuations in the density of the condensate. And there's something else I can look at, and that is the probability that two sites are connected to each other, but not in the condensate, in the finite cluster. These are different quantities. For certain models, for example, two-dimensional percolation, you can show that these are essentially the same thing, but they're not necessarily the same thing. Now, that suggests that if P is supercritical, that we can look at a model where, roughly speaking, you can just look at the finite clusters, or if you want, remove the infinite cluster and see what's left over, see how what's left over behaves as P tends down to PC. Sometimes this is called destructive percolation. Now, the results of another mean field calculation are as follows. Well, if Q is greater than 2, the transition is first order. Nothing interesting happens whatsoever. For Q between 0 and 1, it's the theory of the finite clusters above PC is the same as the theory of finite clusters below PC. So same as the full theory. And furthermore, at least in the mean field theory, it's the same as the case Q equals 1. All these things between 0 and 2, not inclusive and not inclusive. I'm not going to talk about this non-inclusive today. Are the same. But let's look at Q equals 2. So I can define this as the average size of finite clusters. Incidentally, to make contact with the spin system, for the easing magnet, two kinds of correlation functions that are natural to look at if this is a polymer one. For the easing magnet, these two correlation functions contribute exactly equally to the truncated spin-spin correlation function. And for the Q-state POTS model, each one of them makes a contribution, but the coefficient depends on Q.
But mean field theory, specifically Bethe-Lattice or something?
Bethe-Lattice and the other one, yeah.
Or other variants as well?
Yeah, the complete graph is fine. So I can look at the average size of finite clusters. And Hoki, that's what it looks like. This is not one, this is a half. That's different. And I can look at, let me see, the probability that two sites are in the same finite cluster. and that's going to decay exponentially. I have to make some sense about what this means if anybody really knows how to do these calculations, but assuming that they don't, I can just proceed forward and say that this diverges like p minus pc to the 1/4. And if I also look at this business where I erase the infinite cluster and then look at the probability of observing a bond, well, that goes to its nominal value, like p minus pc to the old beta. So beta is a half. And there's the delta. But on the other hand, this is, after all, you know, the using magnet, and there are, either the graphical representation or the spin system, the usual set of critical exponents, namely 1, a half, a half, and if you're worried about delta, it's 3. So we're finding something in the easing magnet that we never suspected. And I'll mention a few things about it which are interesting. This is apparently insensitive to disorder, and the upper critical dimension changes. And so you wonder, or not, if the bound no bigger than 2 over d holds, if you add disorder. And there's a theorem that it does. That was proved by me. But this system doesn't. So this is a peculiar situation, I would say. And all coming from the easing magnet in high dimension. So
that's the, what is the upper critical dimension for this?
8 and 6. 8 and 6. So 4, 6, and 8. Can't beat that with a stick, as my sister from Texas would say. So it's like Dorothy, you know, from the Wizard of Oz. You learn everything just by never leaving your own background. So there's some possibility, and a real scary possibility, that all of this stuff is just an artifact of mean field theory. Very, very interesting things occur in mean field theories of spin glasses. And then there are warring camps that say, okay, look, I mean, you do this in this model, and that happens in this model, but in a real spin glass of finite dimensions, nothing like that. Is that the case here? And K-core type models have been examined in low dimension. So this is one thing that we did. I'm not going to describe the model. It's hard to find this, okay? You cannot do this in two dimensions with nearest neighbor interactions. You just fail. They're preemptive transitions. So you have to look at models of extended range. And, well, the range kept extending and extending and extending, and it didn't look like it was ever going to stop. So, in fact, more due to my collaborators than myself, did some clever things to try to restore force balance. And also, I should mention the work of the enemy team. They have these same kinds of results in the so-called kinetically constrained easing models. All the relevant features that I'm talking about appear, but there have not been any proofs. In fact, I regard this as a very outstanding open problem in sort of low-dimensional, old-fashioned statistical mechanics. But at any rate, well, I don't even want you to look at this. I guess you should plot something versus something else, but it seems important. It's a discontinuous transition, yes. And incidentally, again, plotting something versus something else and asking if you get a straight line, you have a correlation length exponent of 1.5. A beta of 1, which is far away from easing, far away from percolation. And a second correlation length exponent of a half. So, pardon? That's 1/10 the correlation length exponent. So I think that a lot of this is interesting in its own right, and certainly interesting from the perspective of the physics of the blast transition. But how about from the perspective of many of the people in this room? Well, let's look at it. Obviously, we have some form of critical transition. We have not only one diverging landscape, we have two diverging landscapes. It's manifestly apparent, nevertheless, that at the transition point, there is a space-filling object. And furthermore, although I'll be extremely vague about this, because I don't quite know how to formulate the thoughts yet, but it's not just that you have diverging length scales, but the diverging length scales have geometric significance. So, I don't know, maybe this is, this I regard as a very, very hard problem, because, you know, it's not as though Ising magnet was proved to have a phase transition, well, 50 years ago, more, 60. You know, and we're working up, and just a few months ago, we can then establish that continuum limit can be understood. Here, you don't even have a proof that this phase transition occurs. The phase transition of this curve of this sort does exist, and that's already a hard problem, as some of my collaborators and students will attest to. No really substantial progress has been made on that in the last couple of years. But if you're looking for something that has critical behavior and fills space, I think that this may be a reasonable place to start. At any rate, I think this is a reasonable place for me to end, so I'll do that.